From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. The Minnesota Health Department says the second person in the United States known to be infected with the Omicron variant is a man from Hennepin County who had been vaccinated and who had also traveled by plane just before he got sick last week. Here's the Minnesota Health Commissioner, Jan Malcolm.
The person spoke with MDH case investigators and reported traveling to New York City and attending the Anime New York City 2021 convention at the Javits Center, which was held from November 19th to the 21st.
The spread of the new variant is prompting governments around the world to tighten restrictions. Later this hour, we expect President Biden to unveil his own plan to slow down a new wave of infections. Rob Stein, NPR science editor, joins us now. Rob, tell us more about this second case of Omicron found in the U.S.
Yeah, so as you said, it's a man from Minnesota who developed mild symptoms the Monday before Thanksgiving and got tested 2 days later. Turns out he had COVID even though he was fully vaccinated, and it turns out it was the Omicron variant. He's since recovered, but this is the second confirmed case in this country. The first was someone who apparently caught the virus in South Africa and tested positive after returning home to San Francisco. And the possible significance of this second case is that the man, as you said, had just gotten back from this anime convention at the Javits Center in New York City. So far, there's no indication he had traveled internationally. So that raises the question of whether he caught the virus in New York or, you know, while traveling to or from the convention. And if so, that would make it the first case of someone catching the Omicron variant in this country. And that would indicate the virus is spreading here.
And that's why we expect to hear from President Biden shortly. One thing that we don't expect the president to call for is further lockdowns or restrictions on the unvaccinated. Is that right, Rob?
That's right. That's right. You know, the president has, you know, made it pretty clear that basically he's not going to go there. And the bottom line is that there just isn't kind of the political will or appetite for anything like that at this point, you know, especially 2 years into this pandemic. The country's just exhausted. And you may have noticed the federal officials have started talking again, you know, more about the importance of masks and encouraging people to mask up again, especially when they're in crowded, poorly ventilated places where there may be unvaccinated people. But these are not mask mandate. These are just kind of urging people to do what that sort of thing to protect themselves, because the administration is clearly banking on the vaccines to be the nation's primary weapon. And they're now especially focused on boosting as many fully vaccinated people as possibly, as quickly as possible, to try to shore up their protection, especially, you know, because of this new Omicron variant.
On the issue of travel, we expect the president to say that starting next week, all travelers to the United States will need to provide proof of a negative test within a day before boarding their flights. Tell us more about that and whether testing to board domestic flights might be under consideration.
Yeah. So they're basically, they're trying to tighten up on the testing for, you know, international travelers to try to catch any cases sooner and try to, you know, do whatever they can to slow down this variant. But, you know, so far there's no indication that they're going to do anything like that for domestic travel. And that's something that, you know, a lot of public health experts have been pushing for a long time. They would like to see the same standards that are in place for international travel be applied to domestic travel. You know, get tested or get vaccinated if you want to travel in the United States. That would be, you know, would help protect and slow down the spread of the virus. And it would be a big incentive to get more people vaccinated, which is still the most important thing to do right now. But, you know, it's would be something that would be pretty politically unpopular. And so far, the administration just hasn't been willing to go there.
Yeah. In January, the White House is planning to make millions of at-home coronavirus tests free to uninsured or underinsured people at community health centers. But he's also asking, the president is asking for others to go through the process of getting reimbursed by private insurance. What are the hopes there?
You know, that is, you know, important that it'll help. I hope it'll make it, you know, more affordable for people to get tested more frequently. And that's important because these tests in this country are not cheap. And testing has never really been more important, especially, again, with this new Omicron variant, if it, you know, spreads more easily and could make people sick and end up in a hospital. So, Many public health experts I've been talking to say that this doesn't go nearly far enough, though. You know, first of all, it's really cumbersome to require people to go through the trouble of getting reimbursed from their insurance companies for their tests. You know, they would like to see the administration making these tests, especially these rapid home tests, widely available for free, like they are in Britain. And second of all, this does nothing about the supply problem. Anyone who's tried to get one of those quick home tests lately knows how hard they can be to find. The administration's trying to fix that problem, but so far, it's really still been a big problem.
Rob Stein is NPR's health correspondent. Rob, I know you will be, of course, tracking this throughout the course of the day. So thank you very much for taking some time with us right now.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Eviction protections in some parts of the country are set to expire this month, and that could lead to a surge of cases in housing courts. In Oregon, a rental assistance program ended this week. State lawmakers may replenish the fund in a special session, but there's already a backlog of housing cases, and the vast majority of tenants have no legal representation. So the Oregon State Bar wants to let paralegals step in and advocate for clients in a way that's normally reserved for attorneys. Here to explain the idea is Kirsten Thompson. She's a senior circuit court judge in Oregon and a member of the state bar committee that's been working on this proposal. Judge Thompson, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And real quick, for those of us who didn't go to law school, can you explain the difference between lawyer and paralegal? I've seen some proponents of this plan say it's akin to doctor or nurse practitioner.
I think that that's a good analogy. You know, each state licenses legal professionals according to their own regulations and standards. But in most states, there are only licensed attorneys. What Oregon is looking at is licensing paralegals in the discrete areas of landlord-tenant and family law. So the proposal that we have created would allow a paralegal to represent tenants, also landlords, if a landlord desired to hire a paralegal, but to represent tenants without having an attorney necessarily supervise them.
It sounds like you're saying this could kind of level the playing field. Both sides could have somebody who's not a lawyer necessarily, but has some legal training to step in as their advocate. And the numbers are really striking. You found, right, that 83% of people in landlord-tenant disputes over the past 5 years in Oregon did not have any representation at all. Can you give us a sense of who these people are? What are the main reasons they show up in court without an attorney?
Well, the primary reason that people don't hire attorneys for legal issues is because they can't afford an attorney. Attorneys in Oregon, and I think this is fairly typical nationwide, their hourly rate is usually about $250 an hour for the typical attorney. The hope is that with allowing there to be licensed paralegals, more folks would have access to consulting with a trained professional. You know, perhaps having a trained professional assist them in the court process, which they just don't have right now.
You're making the case that some representation is better than none. And to be clear, these paralegals wouldn't be just coming out of the woodwork. They would need 250 hours of attorney supervision in landlord-tenant law under your plan. But I wonder if you still think there could be some risk here for people getting legal advice from folks who, you know, haven't gotten their law degrees, haven't passed the bar.
The idea is not that paralegals will replace attorneys, because attorneys are still absolutely going to be needed. If this program is instituted in the way that we hope it will be, a person who's going to seek licensure, they will typically be someone who has at least an associate's degree in paralegal studies. They'll actually have 1,500 hours of supervised work under an attorney's supervision. The paralegals will be what are called associate members of the Oregon State Bar. They'll have a limited license. They'll be subject to the same kind of consumer protections that attorneys now are in Oregon. So to the extent that our committee was able to do so, we just built in as many training and consumer protection criterion as we could, while at the same time making the program accessible for qualified folks to participate.
So there are still some hurdles to clear. I know the State Bar is taking public comment into February. You'd need sign-off from the state's highest court. But if this program does go into effect, as you hope, could you see it as a national model? As far as we know, this would be the first program of its kind, at least for housing courts.
You know, I think that there are that it is a trend nationally. I think there are 10 states right now that either have or are looking at a program for licensing paralegals. Our neighbor to the north, Washington State, currently has a program for licensing legal technicians in the area of family law. California is looking at a licensure of paralegals in a broad number of areas, including housing. Utah, Arizona, a number of states are looking at licensure of paralegals. So I think it really is a national trend. Oregon is not the only state that is trying to grapple with this and trying to provide a middle ground that provides, you know, appropriate services and a meaningful screening of a case to see whether or not it needs to go to an attorney for further work. Right now, we don't have that middle ground very much for people. It's an all or nothing.
That's Kirsten Thompson. She's a senior circuit court judge in Oregon and a member of the Oregon State Bar. Kirsten, thank you.
Hi, you're very welcome. Thank you.
President Biden is going all in on wind power. Earlier this year, the White House called for 30 gigawatts of offshore wind power by 2030. That's enough to power 10 million homes. It is a tall order, but the administration has recently approved a new project off the coast of New York and another near Martha's Vineyard. And wind is growing onshore as well. Last year, the U.S. added more wind power capacity than any other type of energy. Let's look into its future with Lucy Pau. She's a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and a fellow at the Renewable and Sustainable Energy Institute. Lucy, welcome.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. And I need to settle an important question right out of the gate here. Is it turbines or turbines?
I say turbines.
Okay. Turbines. That's what we'll use through the course of this conversation.
Okay.
All right. So wind turbines. We've got that settled.
Yeah.
Wind turbines generated just about 8%, or just over 8% of the electricity in this country last year. But the Biden administration recently approved these two offshore wind farms in the Atlantic. Tell me about the significance of those projects.
Oh, so I think this is it's wonderful. And so, you know, Biden's goal of 30 gigawatts by 2030, I think, is really speeding up some of the approval processes for offshore wind farms. And I think these first two, Vineyard Wind and South Fork, are wonderful initial steps.
And I'm no expert, but I understand that these are fixed bottom wind farms, meaning that they're attached to the ocean floor. Can you explain how the power gets from the turbines out in the ocean to New York State, for example?
Yes. So these are fixed bottom wind turbines, which means that the wind turbines are built all the way down to the ocean floor. And as they generate electricity, there are transmission cables that have to come from that offshore wind farm onto land.
Well, let's talk about the innovations on offshore, because there's lots of it coming. What are floating turbines, and how far off are we from that technology?
Yeah, so floating wind turbines really will unlock the potential of offshore wind, in particular in the United States, because nearly all of the West Coast will be deep water offshore, and that's where floating wind will be needed. So essentially, once you get to more than 60 or 80 meters deep, then it doesn't make sense to build these fixed bottom offshore wind turbines all the way down to the ocean floor. It becomes much more economical to consider floating wind. And so then essentially there are floating platforms on top of which we have the wind turbines. But there's a lot of interest worldwide.
Speaking of worldwide, in Denmark, I see that they just installed a 108-meter blade in a prototype plant. That's longer than a football field for people here in the United States. Why are these blades getting so big? That's just tremendous.
Right. And so in an effort to drive down the cost of wind energy and have it be more and more competitive, and at this point it is quite competitive with, you know, natural gas and other types of energy, wind turbines have been growing in size over the last several decades. And at this point, you know, the major wind turbine manufacturers are looking at wind turbines that are, you know, more than 10 megawatts, especially for offshore. And so I believe the wind turbine that you're talking about in Denmark is a 14 megawatt wind turbine. It's a prototype. I believe it's a Siemens Gamesa turbine. Mm. And so these are the sizes that are being considered. And in large part, you know, even considering, you know, in the future, even larger turbines, mostly to drive down the cost of wind energy.
So a lot of innovations are coming. If you're a fan of wind energy, that's great. If you're not, it could be cause for concern. There are some environmentalists who actually worry about the impact on wildlife and birds. Many fishermen don't appreciate the wind farms mm-hmm. out in the ocean. What kind of problems does wind power face that might limit its growth potential?
Yeah, great question. I think those of us who work in wind energy, I think we are interested in clean energy and in helping the environment. And the bigger picture really is to understand, you know, how these ecological systems are affected by wind energy. And most of us are very interested in better understanding kind of that whole picture. And I think all these aspects do need to be accounted for as wind projects move forward.
Is it true that there are small pockets of the country that can already meet 100% of their energy needs with wind alone?
I believe so. Right now, at least by state, Iowa is in the lead. They have, on average, across a year, about 60% of their electrical energy needs being met by wind. And some mm-hmm. local pockets within Iowa are even higher. So I read somewhere that the Des Moines, Iowa metro area has about 80% of its energy being met by wind. And I would imagine that instantaneously, maybe across a few hours here and there throughout the year, they probably get very close to 100% wind.
So it's remarkable. And if that's the case, how much of a role do you think this technology can play in the energy needs of the U.S. in the coming decades? Like, how much of our portfolio could it make up?
I think wind can make up maybe 50% of the U.S. energy needs. I think, you know, there is a lot of wind resource as well as solar resource in the U.S. and, you know, along with hydro and nuclear and other clean energy sources, I think we can meet the 100% energy goals.
Lucy Powell is a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and a fellow at the Renewable and Sustainable Energy Institute. Professor Powell, thanks for talking about wind with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a year since the start of one of the biggest nonviolent protest movements in the history of India. Farmers, some of the country's poorest workers, have been on the front lines. They've been protesting the deregulation of crop sales, parading in tractors through the capital, New Delhi, building huge protest camps, and blocking highways for an entire year. And it worked. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from New Delhi.
A sugarcane farmer in a bright green turban chants a prayer song at a giant protest camp erected in the middle of a Delhi highway. Over the past year, Ram Kumar Pagdiwale has built a little shrine here, with jars of water from the Ganges River, soil from his farm, and an oil lamp that holds special meaning. It's a lamp his ancestors first lit in 1947, he explains, during India's struggle for independence. It brought success back then, too, he says. And now, Prime Minister Narendra Modi has capitulated to these farmers. He's taking back the three controversial laws they've spent a year agitating against. Finally, you've admitted your mistakes, sings a poet who's camped out with these farmers all year. Another person who's joined the farmers' movement is the famous social activist Medha Patkar. She compares this to Gandhi's movement.
This is a great victory of the non-violent people's struggle following the path shown by Mahatma Gandhiji.
Gandhi was struggling against a colonial power. These farmers have been struggling against a powerful government that passed free market agriculture reforms without consulting them.
Across the world, the democratic governance is collapsing, yet we have a ray of hope.
But while farmers call this their victory, there's one way in which it could actually benefit their foe, Modi.
Well, this is entirely electoral.
Economist Jayati Ghosh says elections are coming early next year in the key states of Uttar Pradesh and Punjab. Modi wants farmer votes there.
He wants to wipe away the very bitter memory that farmers have of his own words. He called them professional agitators. All kinds of abuse was thrown their way. So he wants to make everyone forget this before the elections.
Ram Kumar, the sugarcane farmer, isn't sure whether it'll work. He's from Uttar Pradesh. He voted for Modi's party once in the past. But he says he's undecided now. Farmers are also undecided about whether to stay in these protest camps or go home. They're holding assemblies to make plans. Meanwhile, after a year, this camp looks more like a city that would be difficult to pack up. There are cafeterias, hundreds of tents, thousands of cots.
This is a water tank and there's a man doing laundry. Hello. Are you washing your clothes?
Some farmers want to stay longer. One of them is Pardeep Huda. He says they have more demands. They want the government to enshrine into law minimum prices for their crops. Why back down now after such a victory, he asks. Plus,
I will miss all these friends because it's a 1 year long. Now these are my families. This is the best year of my life. It really educated me how to fight, how to live.
This past year of protests has been a learning experience for him, he says, and for Prime Minister Modi, too. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, at the Ghazipur protest camp on the edge of New Delhi.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Santa Claus is coming to town. Where is he? There's a shortage of actors who play Santa at malls and company parties during the Christmas season. But the Kringles we spoke with say, have no fear, Santa will be there.
The Christmas community is a microcosm of the overall community in the U.S.
Tom Carmody is a Santa from Westminster, Colorado, and founder of the Rocky Mountain chapter of IBRBS, formerly known as the International Brotherhood of Real Bearded Santas. He told us last year he started going down virtual chimneys, making video calls with children because of the pandemic. But this year, there's more demand for in-person visits.
So, you know, even though we are still getting some cancellations because of the influx or the uptake of the COVID-19 virus and the mutations that thereof, we are still maintaining a pretty good appointment base.
Carmody says some Santas are sitting out this year, fearing COVID-19 still makes appearances too risky. That means people like him are busier than ever, bringing holiday cheer to families that felt cooped up in 2020.
I have six different country clubs that I'll be doing this year. And I've had to bring in some extra Santas to help. So doing not as many home visits as I had in the past. But if you include the video, I have 2 days off between now and Christmas Day.
Oh, Merry Christmas.
Ed Taylor is founder of the Worldwide Santa Claus Network. He's known for portraying Saint Nick in the Los Angeles area, and he's also appeared in commercials and on TV. Today, he says most of his fellow Santa's schedules are packed tighter than a stocking on Christmas morning. Many, like him, are still doing virtual visits from their ho-ho homes.
I've been doing the video and the virtual visits for many years. I think I started in 2011, doing some via Skype and that sort of thing. But I've transitioned to doing all virtual visits.
Taylor finds families like virtual visits because they can spend more quality time with him and don't have to wait in long lines with tired kids. Remote work is nice for him, too. He used to have a long commute to his TV gigs, Presumably the reindeer appreciate a break too. And like many remote workers during the pandemic, he's relishing extra time at home with the little elves in his life.
The COVID kind of shut down the entertainment industry work, and I have two young grandkids who actually are in the other room. You might hear them any moment now, but my wife and I, Mrs. Claus and I, care for while their parents are working. And so it was just a wonderful thing to stay home. It was, and the time was right. It just worked out.
So whether you see a professional Santa in person, on a screen, or not at all this year, there's one thing all those Santas want children, and children at heart, to know. The real Santa is still making his list, checking it twice, and readying his sleigh for Christmas Eve. Again, Santa Tom Carmody.
So even if we can't hug each other, that's not going to stop Santa from doing what he loves to do, and that's to bring a smile to their faces, bring joy to the world, and to give everybody hope that we will at some point in time return to normal.
Winter is coming, and that makes homelessness even more worrisome in communities across the country. America's unhoused population had grown at an annual rate of 2% when measured in 2020, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and Secretary Marcia Fudge presented the data in stark terms earlier this year.
What makes these findings even more devastating is that they are based on data from before COVID-19, and we know the pandemic has only made the homelessness crisis worse.
Here in Boston, for example, an encampment near a major intersection grew to hundreds of people over the summer. It's brought renewed urgency to a debate about public health and access to housing. Deborah Becker is a senior correspondent for WBUR. She's been reporting on the site and joins us now. Hey, Deb.
Hi, Cal.
So, I mean, there are encampments like this one in Boston all over the country, as you know. Some of them are even bigger. Can you describe what life has been like in this tent village that straddles Boston's South End and Roxbury neighborhoods?
Right. Well, for years in this area of Boston, there have been complaints about people living on the streets, loitering. The situation's been described as a humanitarian crisis. Hundreds of people, no facilities to wash, a lot of trash, a lot of drug use, increased crime. So in October, the city issued an executive order saying that it would start removing sections of tents. But the then acting mayor said that city workers would first post notices, giving people 48 hours to move, would offer people shelter and bins to store their belongings. And on a day when the tents were being moved, I spoke with a man named Ron Geddes. He's been living in the encampment for months. He said he lost his job during the pandemic, and he can't go to the shelter that city officials offered because of his mental health issues. He said high housing costs have kept him living in a tent. Here's what he said.
I'm not asking for anything more than affordable housing. That's it. They hope I do something wrong so they can arrest me, so they can get me out of the streets. That's what they're hoping on, and it's not going to happen.
And Cal, arresting people was something that the city said it could do if someone refused to move a tent.
One of the things that Mr. Geddes was hinting at there, though, Deb, is that some people have moved on to other housing, at least temporary housing. What did that involve? Where are folks now?
Well, some people have moved because of the cold. And the latest numbers from the city as of this week indicate that in the past month, more than 250 people have been placed in addiction treatment or mental health treatment, and about 40 people have gone to transitional housing. Some local business leaders have been working with the city on this. I spoke with Sue Sullivan, who heads the Neighborhood Business Group, and she said many businesses haven't been able to fully operate because there are so many tents. So she's been out on the streets coordinating with city health officials. Let's listen.
I feel so passionately that these people should not be in these tents. The depravity that's happening, I can't be party to. And so if I can make change, I will.
But honestly, many people in the encampment simply moved their tent a few blocks away. Some of the folks say that they formed a community with those in the tents and they look out for each other. And the numbers from the city this week suggest there are now about 90 tents remaining in the area with almost 180 people living in them.
Very much still active. But Deb, you did mention the city's effort to remove this tent village in October. The ACLU fought that with a lawsuit. I should note that lawsuit was filed when Boston had an acting mayor. As you mentioned, there's a newly elected mayor now, Michelle Wu. She just took office a couple of weeks ago. So what's the latest on this front?
Well, the ACLU's lawsuit alleges that the city was not offering people appropriate shelter options before tents were moved and was destroying personal property, and that the removals were a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Because of that suit, the city and new mayor Michelle Wu paused tent removals, and both sides are meeting on this as the legal action continues.
So, Deb, I mean, the homelessness situation reached kind of a crisis point at this major intersection over the summer, but the problem itself is not new to the city of Boston, like many other cities across the country. So the new mayor, Michelle Wu, is inheriting a problem that many previous mayors have struggled to solve. So what is her plan?
Well, the focus really is on this encampment, although acknowledging that this is a broader problem than just this encampment at a busy intersection and is very visible. Shortly after she was elected, Mayor Wu promised to take a public health approach to those who are unhoused and those in the encampment. And here's what she said after her first briefing.
I mean, you can't be satisfied when people are still in tents in the cold, disconnected from opportunity and housing. So I won't be satisfied until we have leadership in place, a clear process, and the resources to connect people to that housing and treatment.
And Wu said the city is considering various potential solutions, especially creating more of what's called low-threshold housing, which provides shelter without as many restrictions as traditional homeless shelters. The state's also involved here because it's estimated that, at least in the encampment, more than half of those there are not from Boston. So there have been some small steps to create alternative housing, and various agencies are involved to try to provide this, especially with winter now here.
Yeah, long way to go still, and the temperatures just keep dropping. That's Deborah Becker, senior correspondent for WBUR. Deb, thank you.
You're welcome.
For most bookworms, the holidays are the perfect time to treat yourself and your shelf. But this year, a book shortage has many booksellers worried they'll be unable to meet demand. Here in Now's Kalyani Saxena has more.
At Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts, nearly every shelf bears a crisp white poster urging customers to pre-order and shop early. And the message seems to be getting through to customers like Louise Tansky.
I live in the neighborhood, so I come in here pretty regularly just to check out the new books. But I know that things are probably going to be short come December, so I definitely have been thinking about getting things a little bit earlier than usual.
When Leah Green came into the store, there was only one copy left of the romance novel she wanted.
I came looking for the book I have now, so I was able to find it. I think they did say this was the last one, so if anyone else wants it, too bad for them.
It's not just romance novels that are in short supply. Rachel Cass, the store's buying and inventory manager, says this year's shortage is unique because it's affecting books across all genres. And people are buying more books. Printed book sales in the U.S. rose by more than 13% this year compared to last. That's according to NPD BookScan, which tracks book sales.
So every year stuff goes out of stock, especially if something ends up on somebody's end-of-year list or wins a big prize at the end of the year. This year it seems like it's just more books and it's earlier.
Cass says the store tried to get ahead of the shortage by ordering more inventory earlier.
I don't think we're going to make it all the way through to Christmas without running out of some key things, but at least at the moment, we're in pretty good shape.
But it's a different story at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop, a sci-fi fantasy bookstore in New Orleans. Candace Huber is the owner and says their store is already feeling the pinch of the book shortage.
Just the other day, I went to go order a book. I sent it in to the publisher, and they emailed me back saying, FYI, there's only 200 of these books left in the warehouse. So I said, okay, can I up my order? They emailed me back and they were like, just kidding, it's sold out and the reprint's not coming until March.
So why not print more books? Well, according to Huber, that's where the problems start.
Most publishers print books internationally, and so international shipping is a huge mess right now. There's a container shortage.
Add to that the issue of printing itself.
Because there's been so much consolidation over the years, now there are only a couple of printers that are printing, like, all the books.
And
on top of the paper shortage, on top of shipping issues, like once they do get printed, we have a driver shortage and warehouse worker shortages and just everything across the board.
Despite those issues, Huber says there's no need to toss your book buying wish list just yet.
If there is the one true book that you want, you should have ordered it already. But if you haven't, go for it like right now. Otherwise, be flexible and lean on your local booksellers in their expertise to bring you something that you probably didn't even know you wanted.
And Rachel Cass of Harvard Bookstore hopes customers will do just that. She says she's cautiously optimistic about how business will fare this holiday season.
After a couple of really challenging years, I'm not saying things are back to normal, but it's been really, really nice to see really excellent books come out this year and people being really excited to come and buy them.
And as people continue to buy more books in this pandemic, booksellers may finally be able to turn the page on this chapter of uncertainty. For Here and Now, I'm Kalyani Saxena.
It's been a little more than a year since Colorado experienced the biggest wildfires in the state's history. Now experts are thinking about how to restore the forests that burned and exactly what a healthy forest looks like. Colorado Public Radio's Miguel Otarola reports.
How about the trails? What do we do if we walk off the trail? What do we do to respect?
Spread out.
Very good. Spread out.
Awesome. At the Cowwood Education Center, just northwest of Denver, it's never too early to learn about the outdoors. The campus tucked away high up in the mountains of the Roosevelt National Forest. On this crisp morning, a group of young kids are going over the game plan before they start a day-long trek through the woods.
Just keep hydrated and go to the bathroom when you need to. Don't wait. Don't wait and wait and wait.
Yeah.
But the center's executive director, Rafael Salgado, has something else on his mind. How to salvage more than half of the nearby forest that burned in a wildfire last year. The Cowwood Fire covered more than 10,000 acres and burned entire mountainsides to a crisp, leaving nothing but charred tree trunks poking out of the dusty ground. Salgado wonders what he can do to make the forest grow again.
You know, I was asking some experts, you know, where's the recipe for that? You know, where is it? Where can I follow a recipe so that I can actually do that? And they told me that they don't have one yet.
Forests are massive, so to make them more manageable, they've been sliced into different sizes. Some are owned by private homeowners, and others by the federal government. So, what's the best way to replant a forest to meet the needs of all those users? Answering this question is increasingly urgent as fires burn larger and hotter due to climate change.
I'm gonna go in the front and the back?
I'll go in the back.
To get a better sense of the challenges ahead, Salgado and I hopped in his pickup truck and drove into the burn scar. Over the years, Salgado and his team have cut down trees, limiting how far wildfires spread in the forest.
The fire came through here, and I knew that this forest was going to survive.
They weren't able to cut every section before the fire, including the tops of mountains that he says belong to another landowner.
If you look up the hill, those trees didn't survive.
A little less than half of the land burned by the Cowwood Fire was managed by Boulder County. At least 20 homes were lost or damaged. The county had cut down trees beforehand. It also lit controlled fires to help manage overgrowth. Stefan Reinold is Boulder County's senior forester. He says that all groups are responsible for restoring their own land, though there are opportunities to coordinate the work.
One of the terms that's used is completing random acts of restoration doesn't quite, you know, help solve the problem.
It's not exactly a cohesive approach, but Reinold says different areas of the forest may have different priorities.
There isn't a one-size-fit-all, and I don't even think there should be. If it's your property, right, and it burned, and you want to have trees on your property, then I think it's okay for you to plant some trees.
The Nature Conservancy has a slightly different view. The organization is experimenting with tens of thousands of seeds in ponderosa pine forests across the state. Catherine Schlegel is the watershed forest manager for the group's Colorado chapter. She hopes their work will lead to a reforestation recipe for land managers like Salgado. The research isn't complete, but Schlegel has a pretty good idea what a healthy forest should look like after it's restored.
They should look like small islands. When we see small islands, it's dense, it's clumpy, it's irregular, it's imperfect, and that's a forest.
Schlegel says the best time to replant is right after a wildfire, when there are no animals or vegetation in the way. Her team planted seeds in little pods and paired them with chili seeds, so predators don't disrupt their growth. Schlegel says foresters need to start collecting more seeds, 10 times the current amount. Only then can they create the blueprint the Forest Service, local governments, and landowners are desperate for.
They're saying, can I do this? Is this ready? We're saying we're still in a learning phase.
On the drive back to the education center, Director Salgado spots a group of high school students planting trees on the burned hillside. They had been working all morning and still had another section of the forest to go.
There you go, look at that. You planted a tree.
I'm the Lorax.
Salgado and many land managers are doing what they can with the knowledge they currently have. Right now, that means planting trees grown in nurseries to replace what was lost. Until new strategies take root. For Here and Now, I'm Miguel Otarola.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.